Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. Our speaker is Ahmed Kourou, Associate Professor of Political Science at San Diego State University. Professor Kourou's lecture is titled Secular States and Religions, Comparing the United States, France, and Turkey. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Dr. Robert Heffner, Director of the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs.
Every so often, an idea comes across the landscape of intellectual and political discussion in the West and in other countries that sort of captures the attention of a lot of people, particularly policymakers. One of those topics that has captured the attention of both the public and policymakers over the last now better part of 20 years is the question of the relationship of religion and state and the allied idea of secularism, which is some kind of governance regime for regulating the relationship of religion and state, and about which Professor Kourou will have much to say today. Part of the reason, part of the inspiration and if you will, attention to the idea had, of course, to do with discussions that began in the mid-1990s, not least of all with the debate inspired by Sam Huntington's work. Sam Huntington, whom I might add, has sat in this room on many occasions. He's passed away now. But who voiced a certain conviction as to the type of governance regime required of religion and state for democracy to take hold, and voiced the conviction in particular that that regime of governance, the, if you will, relationship through which state managed religion had to be secular, if that, and secularist, if that state were to hope to become democratic. Of course, he went well beyond that, and made a number of arguments as to the likely societies and indeed whole civilizations that were capable of generating, of evolving a kind of secular politics. And he pointed to two in particular that were problematic, one that he called Confucian and the other of which he described as Muslim or Islamic. He identified these as particularly problematic societies for a variety of reasons, not just secular ones. But Islam he singled out as particularly problematic because, as he said in what has become a very famous quote, in Islam, unlike in the West, there is no separation of religion and state allowed because in Islam, God is Caesar. So if you will, there's a kind of theocratic imperative in Islam and in Muslim politics that makes this, in his view, critical condition of secularity impossible, and therefore democracy impossible in Muslim-majority societies. That was the beginning of what was, over the next few years, a very, very heated discussion and debate, as I've said in another context. In U.S. policy circles, Huntington's thesis inspired an enormous amount of controversy and debate, so much so that in, I believe it was the Clinton administration era, but it continued into the Bush era, there was an effort, if you will, to reassure our Muslim friends that indeed the State Department did not subscribe to Sam Huntington's views on Islam and democracy. But there was a kind of more interesting scholarly blowback from the Huntington thesis, which had a kind of ironic but really intellectually interesting effect. And it was that by, if you will, characterizing the West in such monolithic terms as secular, and everywhere secular, and intrinsically secular, going all the way back to the first years of the Jesus movement. And conversely, by describing Muslim-majority societies as, if you will, antithetical to both secularism and democracy, he, if you will, launched a number of scholarly ships of dissertation students, researchers, and policymakers looking at, well, precisely what is the relationship between religion and state in the West and in Muslim societies? I know of no one in the field of political theory, political science, and international relations who has, if you will, captured the attention at quite his age, quite his youth, with his first book, as has our guest today, Professor Ahmed Kuru of San Diego State University. Professor Kuru was born and raised in Turkey, but got his PhD here at the University of Washington, Seattle. But he engaged this question of secularism in politics in a thoroughly original, complex, and scholarly way, not just showing us that Turkey and a number of other Muslim-majority societies around the world are much more complicated in the way in which they regulate religion-state relations than Huntington and many others had suggested. But he went even further, and I think this is what makes him, for me, such a truly remarkable and exciting scholar, and someone who has caught the attention of many senior scholars in the field of political science and political theory. And that is that he brought this kind of reflexive gaze to bear on secularism, not just in Muslim-majority countries, but then in turn on the West. And he presents us with an understanding of the West and governance regimes, the ways in which religion and state are regulated in the West, that is far more complicated than Sam Huntington and any number of other, even quite sophisticated scholars had suggested. Al Stepan, who's a senior theorist, democratic theorist at Columbia University, who's now in his early 70s, once took me aside. It was on the occasion when I first met Ahmed Kuru, took me aside and said, this is one of the really great figures in the new generation of political scientists and political theorists. That message coming from Al Stepan is about as high a praise as one can imagine. And I will, having read his books, having heard Ahmed Kuru speak before, I will second that evaluation and simply end by saying it is a great pleasure to have you here today, and thank you for coming, and I look forward to your presentation. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for the extremely generous introduction. I wish my mother was here, and she would hear that. So it is always good to start with a joke, but I will save it toward the end of the presentation that will have some funny anecdotes from Turkey. Therefore, I would like to start with some serious scientific descriptions, typologies, and question and answers. Then we'll move toward more contemporary issues. So when I was developing the puzzle, I started with categorization, which would help me to compare cases. And when we categorize 193 countries in terms of state religion regimes, there appeared to be four main types. One extreme was anti-religious states with few cases like China, Cuba, I put. Then the other extreme case was religious states like Iran, Saudi Arabia. And in between, 120 cases were secular states, and 60 of them were states with established church. So what makes them different was that the secular state fulfill two criteria. One, they don't have official religions, they don't have officially established religions. Second, their legal systems, lawmaking and court processes, are not under religious control. So the countries, as you can see in the table, all three of my cases, United States, France, and Turkey, are secular by fulfilling both of the criteria, no established religion, no religious control over the legal system, parliaments or courts. So those with established religion, they have the official religion, but their legal system are not under religious control, and those with religious states do not fulfill any of the two criteria. They have official religions and their legal system under religious control. So if you focus on the three red ones, the US, France, and Turkey, the question is, although the three are similarly secular, why do they follow different policies, especially on the crucial issues of schooling? That I look at six policies, and many of you are familiar with the recent headscarf debate, that in the United States we don't have a headscarf or other types of prohibition over religious dress codes, whereas in France and Turkey there is now a particular prohibition. Or if you look at the debate about the Pledge of Allegiance in the United States, we still have under God's phrase in the pledge that doesn't exist in Turkey or France. And even in other policy areas, although we see a similar trend, for example, in all three cases, there is no organized prayer in schools. But the rationale, the reason for banning such thing is different. In the U.S. case, the Supreme Court emphasized that the organized prayer in public schools would mean and pressure over those who do not believe or do not want to be part of the prayer. But in Turkey and France, generally, such kind of prohibitions are referring to the secular state, secular nature or characteristic of the state rather than regarding individuals. So that's why when we look at the six policy areas, sorry for not fitting to the table, but you are all smart people, can understand what's going on in the table. The U.S., France, and Turkey are compared by six policy areas. We can elaborate them in Q&A, but now I just want to briefly summarize that in the United States, there is the general policy of tolerating religion in schools, whereas in France and Turkey, that's not the case. Although there are some exceptions, they still have explanations. For example, in Turkey, there is a religious instruction in public school, yes, but it is directly linked to the fact that private religious education is prohibited. That's why they find a place in the public education, because there's no private institution to do so. So then why? What makes the three cases following two different orientation, inclusionary in the United States and exclusionary in Turkey and France? My own argument is based on passive and assertive secularism, that in Turkey and France, assertive secularism requires the state to play an assertive role to exclude religion from the public sphere. Therefore, in such cases, the state pursues a social engineering policy to make religion as a matter of personal individual conscience, a completely private affair. Whereas in the passive secularism, the state plays a passive role and allows public visibility of religion. So in the book, I try to go beyond the three cases and look at the other cases. Like, for example, in India and Netherlands, in addition to the United States, passive secularism is dominant. And in Mexico, in addition to Turkey and France, assertive secularism has been the dominant ideology. So, before elaborating this argument, I just want to briefly touch upon three alternatives. One alternative explanation is the modernization theory, that the more modern societies are more secularized in a sense that they are less religiously participant or publicly visible. From my political science perspective, the more important thing is definitely secularity of the state more than the people. Therefore, I look at Ronald Engelhardt and Pippa Norris' book, and where they argue that modernization includes the division of church and state and the rise of secular, rational, bureaucratic states. So, in the elegant formulation, modernization theory types analysis generally look at the level of development, UNDP score. And when we look at the UNDP scores, actually, in terms of comparing the three cases, U.S. and France look like similar. They are both highly developed countries in terms of score and rankings, and Turkey is different. Therefore, if it was development and modernization, then U.S. and France would be similar, not Turkey and France. So the modernization theorists may say that they are interested in international trends, not only three cases, but they are looking broader trends at the international level. That's why I analyzed 174 countries. And when I match them with the level of having an official religion or lacking an official religion, the result actually is the opposite. Because in the countries with low level of development, only 5% are secular state with no official, only 5% are state with established church, 95% are secular. So countries with medium development, 41% of them have official religion, and high development have the highest level of having official religion, which is completely the opposite of modernization theory. So then the second theory that Professor Hafner already very insightfully discussed is civilizationalism. Some call Neo-Orientalism or Essentialism of Huntington and Bernard Lewis. So Bernard Lewis, the historian of Middle East, brought the idea that the distinction between church and state, so deeply rooted in Christendom, didn't exist in Islam. And actually, he was the first one who brought the idea of clash of civilization. And then Huntington expanded this idea to all other cultures, in Islam, saying in Islam, God is Caesar, as you quoted. In China and Japan, Caesar is God. In Orthodoxy, God is Caesar's junior partner. Generally, people laugh at this point. So the separation and recurring clashes between church and state that typify Western civilization have existed in no other civilization. Again, if Turkey is a Muslim country, according to this categorization, then France and U.S. are Western, if not Christian, then we should expect a similarity between France and U.S., not France and Turkey. But Huntington and Lewis generally argue that Turkey is an exception with the only secular state in the Muslim world. Therefore, I analyze all the countries in the Muslim world. And the result is that, I don't know, somehow some letters doesn't appear, but again, you understand the big picture here, right, I hope. So the secular states actually exist, and 20 out of 46 Muslim majority countries are secular states. Only 11 are Sharia state with Islamic states, and 15 are in between, like Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, neither a completely Islamic state nor a secular state. I listed, as you see, the secular state 13 alphabetical order, then the other 7 in a different alphabetical order, because the first 13 are the ones who use the term secular republic or the secular state in the Constitution. Even the U.S. Constitution doesn't use it. Only few in the world, like Russia and France, use the term secular state. So therefore, 13 explicitly mention it. 7 of them doesn't use it, but they fulfill the two criteria that no official establishment of Islam and no Islamic control over the entire legal system. So the third theory was the most challenging one for me because he was promoted by one of my dissertation advisors and I had to criticize him, and he was kind enough to receive it. And recently he emailed me saying that, Ahmed, I am teaching your book despite the nonsense you mentioned about my theory. It was a joke, definitely, but some serious stuff included. So the argument of Anthony Gill is that using a rational choice perspective, the politicians make decisions about religious freedom or state policies towards religion in general, and politicians have specific preferences and the ways they calculate costs and benefits, and for them the main three preferences are political survival. So if we think Obama, he prioritized to be re-elected. Then the second thing is the cost of ruling, minimize the cost, maximize revenue. And the final issue is development, economic growth. So my particular criticisms include that in the United States, especially, the Supreme Court members are appointed for life. They don't have the concern of political survival, and they are the main actors shaping specific policies. But and also, this perspective seems to me too much state-centric that politicians make decisions. But in my own understanding, it is more societal struggle with different groups in society. But my broader critique of rational choice is that preferences are given with the social and political status. If you are a peasant, you have a specific preference. If you are a president, you have a particular preference. But for me, ideas and ideologies really shape preferences. That's what is missing in this rational choice perspective. So if you let me summarize my own argument after briefly review the three alternatives. First of all, if we use the methods of difference and similarity of John Stuart Mill, we see that in the U.S. and France are similar in terms of modernization theory and civilizationism, but they are different given their policies toward religion. I argue that's because of their different ideologies. Turkey and U.S. are different given economic development and religion, but they have almost the same results. My argument is that because of their similar ideologies. So then the question is whether countries are monolithically passive secularists or monolithically assertive secularists, in a very brief explanation, in a paragraph or a few pages, I categorize them passive assertive. But in a deeper analysis, definitely there are ongoing struggles, different groups, and ideological struggles really shape the result, the policies, state policies toward religion. And that's not only the case for secular state, but for almost all other types, you see the importance of ideologies. Because in religious states like Iran, Saudi Arabia, it's Islamist ideology. In countries like China, North Korea, anti-religionism directly linked to communist or atheistic perspective. Secular state have the debates between assertive, passive types. Even in countries like Greece, Denmark, England, there is no clear ideology, passive assertive, but definitely left versus right. Right-wing parties generally pro-religious and left-wing are more pro-secular. So, and in my three cases, what we see is that in the United States, assertive secularists are very marginal. The mainstream groups are all passive secularists. That's what I realized in my interviews with several groups. But they still have a big disagreement between the separationists versus accommodationists. In the general terminology, it's used conservatives for accommodationists and liberals for separationists. So the separationists were dominant in the Supreme Court, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Then the Republicans really try hard. I remember Pat Robertson was praying in the 700 Club TV for one more vacancy in the Supreme Court to be appointed, replaced by President Bush. And now they seems they have four versus five, so four accommodationists, separationists, five accommodations, and now conservatives seem to be having an edge in the court. In France, many people monolithically argue that French don't like this, don't like that, etc. But I think there is no one single France, but there is an ongoing debate in France as well, especially on the issue of Hesca, for example, from 1989 to 2004, two groups struggled. One supported laïcité de combat, combative secularists, what I call assertive secularism, and the other group defending laïcité pluriel, pluralistic secularism, more open-minded. But eventually, the combative secularists became more popular, popularly supported and dominant, and they managed and achieved to get the law passed about banning religious symbols in schools. In Turkey, there is a debate between the Kemalists on the one hand, who argue that they defend the legacy of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. So in the Q&A, I can explain that there is a difference between defending Atatürk's legacy in general, I call them Atatürkist, and a specific ideological groups who thinks that Atatürk's principles are unchangeable. They take it dogmatic. That is what I call them Kemalists. And on the other side, there are liberals and conservatives who wanted to challenge the existing assertive secularism in Turkey with various policies. So, if that's the picture, we are able to understand the connection between policy and ideology. But one thing is missing. Where do ideologies come from? Why is assertive secularism dominant in France? Why passive secularism in the United States? So, my argument is that it is directly linked to the presence or absence of an ancien regime. So the ancien regime requires four main, let's say, necessary conditions. Combined, they are sufficient conditions, but each of the four are necessary conditions. So one, that there should be a local monarchy. Second, there should be an hegemonic religion. Third, the two should ally each other. And fourth, there should be a successful Republican transition. So once the Republicans destroy the monarchy, they also wanted to eliminate hegemonic religion, because the hegemonic religion was regarded as the formal ally of the monarchy. And there is always the potential reemergence of monarchy. And it is called the reconstruction or reestablishment of monarchy and church. That's why the Republicans in these countries, like France, Turkey, and Mexico, are not only concerned about monarchy and its reestablishment, but they are also concerned about religious institutions. So in France and Turkey, the Republicans concerned about Catholicism in France, Islamic institutions in Turkey. Similarly, we see in Mexico. Spain, Portugal had this moment, but they had the short-term assertive secularism replaced by fascism and eventually lead to a more balanced passive secularist contemporary condition. In the Soviet Union, they went even far than further than the assertive secularism, having an anti-religious state. So, very briefly, if you look at Denmark, England, Saudi Arabia, they have local monarchy and hegemonic church, arguably, but there is no republican translation. So one may predict in the future if some people in Saudi Arabia destroy the Wahhabi monarchy, they will also target Saudi monarchy, they will also target Wahhabi clergy as an ally of the monarchy. So Ireland, Iran, and Poland, yes, monarchy and hegemonic religion, but no direct alliance because Catholicism in Ireland and Poland were regarded as a source of resistance against foreign enemies, Russian or British invasion and colonization. And in Iran, definitely the hegemonic religion opposed the Shah. In Germany and Netherlands, multiple religion, Protestant, Catholics, not one religion versus secularism. And in the United States, Canada, Australia, India, especially in the case of U.S., if we focus on no local monarchy, multiple Protestant denominations, therefore no ancien regime. The only minimal ancien regime may be talk about the role of Church of England, because Church of England was tied to British monarchy. Therefore, in the southern colonies, during the revolution, the revolutionaries somehow attack or criticize or sometimes targeted the Church of England. Certain church buildings were closed down and it had to change its name to Episcopal Church. So, if we look at specifically the three cases, I define the three periods as the critical junctures after which we recognize some pet dependency. So critical juncture is an important period of time in which the old institutions are shaken, the new ones are uncertain, and important actors and leaders can play substantial role to change institutional structure. So in the United States, from the revolution to the ratification of the First Amendment was the time when the rationalists and evangelicals had political power, but instead of a severe struggle, they had a Rawlsian overlapping consensus. One reason is that the rationalists like Jefferson were not completely anti-religious because there was no ancien regime in the United States. And the evangelicals, although some of them preferred their own churches be established, they knew that they didn't have hegemony and was impossible to control the entire land. Therefore, the second best choice for them to accept church-state separation. In the French case, the Republicans were anti-clerical. That's what, as a glue, brought them together. And the monarchist Catholics didn't want a separation because that didn't promise them anything. They already had the hegemony. They just tried to protect it. In the Turkish case, the Westernist, later on we may call them Kemalists, attack Islamic institutions, close them madrasas, close them tekkes and zaviyas of the tariqas, because they thought that these institutions were part of the ancien regime. They were part of the old regime. A new Turkey didn't need them and just need to get rid of them. And then Islamists wanted to protect their own hegemony, therefore they didn't support an American type of separation. And the result in both cases, France and Turkey, was a severe conflict which resulted in assertive secularism. That's not the case in the United States. The overlapping consensus produced passive secularist institutional structure. After that historical moment, definitely, in each of the three cases, we have observed transformations, evolutions in the United States. The state was neutral initially only toward Protestants, not toward Catholics and Jews. But eventually it became a neutral state towards the Catholics and Jews as well. And today, out of nine Supreme Court judges, six are Catholics, three Jews, and zero Protestant. Such level of transformation in the United States. In France, until 1950s, there was the strong assertive secularist mood. By De Gaulle, after the Vichy regime, things started to change, especially by the French support, public support, financial support to the Catholic schools. We realized that there is a certain level of moderation. But when it comes to Islam in the later decades, things change. Assertive secularists left, found an alliance with Islamophobic right, and then there was the reemergence of very strong assertive secularism against Muslims, although against Catholicism, things are much more moderate in France right now. So in the Turkish case, we may elaborate it in Q&A, but what we are seeing is that the ancien regime in Turkey was a bit different from the one in France for various reasons. So in Turkey, there was no extraterritorial pope. There was no church holding lands. There was vakıf properties, but it was mostly embedded to society. And there was no celibacy. Imams were getting married. They were part of society as well. That's why it wasn't directly church versus the people, mosque versus the people. Assertive secularism in France had more societal roots. Assertive secularists were winning in elections in France. Therefore, they were bringing assertive secularism in a more democratic way, relatively more bottom-up. But in Turkey, it has been always top-down by the military and by the judicial elite. Until very recently, several unpopular policies like the headscarf ban in universities were kept in an effective way by the military plus judiciary tutelage over the democratic system. And it was actually more radical than the French one, because the headscarf ban in France is only for high schools and only public high schools. But in Turkey, the headscarf ban was becoming almost unlimited thing. Even the guests in the campus were not allowed to get in university campus, mothers of students, for their headscarves. We'll talk about the Turkish case at the very end. So, but that's the general picture about the historical origin, the groups, overlapping consensus versus conflict because of ancien regime, which leads to assertive passive secularism and their origin. But I was explaining how things also change. So we have continuity with change. So in a summary, the argument is that the presence or absence of an ancien regime, which implies monarchy plus hegemonic religion, leads to dominance of assertive or passive secularism despite transformations and ongoing ideological struggles. And the result is inclusionary or exclusionary policy tendencies towards religion, especially in schools. So if we look at the future, what I predict about Turkey is that when we look at the level of religiosity, Turkish society seems to be very highly religious in terms of believing God, affiliating with religion, and mosque participation or praying five times a day for women who do not participate in mosque on Fridays. U.S. society is also relatively more religious than the French one. French seems to be having the lowest level of religiosity. So why does that important? It is important when we match religiosity with ideology. Because in the United States, ideology is passive. The state tolerates. People want to reflect their religiosity in public school, public sphere. That's fine, almost. In the French case, initially there was a big debate after 1905 law, police and even gendarmerie, the sheriffs were getting into the church building. There were severe clash, but that's no longer the case. With the French society, by and large, get more and more secularized, only 10% attending church. They don't want to reflect too much religiosity in public school, public sphere. Yes, the state is restricting, but it is also, by and large, moderated. No big debate except Islam. When it comes to Turkey, that's the more conflict zone out of the three cases, because we have the most religious society, with the most radical assertive secular state. Therefore, since 4 or 5 years, I was predicting that Turkey has two options. One, the people will become French, they become less and less religious, more secular, or the state ideology become American type, embracing passive secularism. So we had Ergün Özbudun when I was a postdoc at Columbia University. Ergün Özbudun was drafting a new constitution for the ruling party's demand. He came to the Columbia, read the publications, really embraced the idea. When he came back, he gave an interview and saying that Turkey will one day become passive secularist. Ahmet Kuru first coined the term, and you cannot stop it, something like that. So the Kemalists attack him, and they attack me, and they publish my picture. Beneath it, it was written, Ahmet Kuru, then passive secularism. So passive secularism from Ahmet Kuru, made in USA. You can see the made in USA. So the article's title was Light Zero Laiklik, because the author, normally he is very respectful, Güneri Civaoğlu, political analyst, who make the comparison between my passive secular with Coca-Cola, saying that they first produced light Coke, then zero Coke. Now he's producing passive secularism, then the next step is zero secularism. Some of my friends say I should sue and it's insulting. I say, no, I'm going to apply for citizenship and naturalization. That's a document that is already made in USA for me. So, and the last thing I want to say, the recent transformation, because the book was published in 2009. The Turkish translation just get published literally yesterday or today in a few days. So when I was going over the Turkish translation, I need to revise the book. Although 2 years is not a long term, but for the Turkish politics it's too long. So what we are seeing in the Turkish politics recently is that there is definitely a shift from assertive to passive secularism. Although in terms of laws, not many change happen regarding the headscarf ban, regarding the discrimination against the graduates of Islamic Imam Hatip schools in the university entrance examination, and even regarding the age restriction for the Quranic courses, because you cannot teach Quran to a kid under 15-year-old in the regular time. Only in summer you can teach between 12 and 15. Until 12 you cannot teach at all. So there is de facto change happens in summer, but de jure change is still expected. We can talk about it later on. And in the French case, what I am observing is that there is more and more emphasis on Islamophobia by the Swiss banning minarets, other dress codes, bans, and this European Court of Human Rights also show some double standards on this issue. And for the United States, police sessions, police la même chose, so not many change because we are all concentrating on economic crisis, possibly. And the final thing I want to mention, the interesting development maybe some of you follow, the Prime Minister Erdogan had the tour of so-called Arab Spring, where he recommended Egyptians, especially in a talk show in the Egyptian opera show, that Egypt should be a secular state and Muslims should not be afraid of secularism, which created a big debate in Turkey, and that's good for my book to be sold in the same week. Yeah. So thanks for your attention.
We'll take questions from the floor.
Ahmet, thank you for coming. That was a very interesting talk, as I knew it would be. I just have a question about your categorization. So you categorize Turkey as different from many of the other European countries, and I was wondering how you make that categorization, because in Turkey, you say that the Turkish state is not... doesn't have an official religion, and yet you have the Diyanet, a government institution that runs the mosques, the imams, the prayer leaders are civil servants. The government decides what's taught in the schools in terms of religious education. It makes laws about who can wear what. It's not just the headscarf, it's religious symbols on the streets are not allowed, priestly collar and so on. So why would that be any different from a place like Germany, where the government collects taxes from people who were Catholic and then give it to the Catholic Church or, you know, for their upkeep? The Turkish government has taken over all of the religious foundation money from the Ottoman Empire and is using that to basically control and define religion even in the private sphere. So that seems to me to be quite different from your more laissez-faire description of Turkey as a secular country.
Thank you. That's a great question. So, first of all, what we are having here, Weberian ideal types, and each and every actual case deviates from the ideal types to a certain extent. Therefore, it's up to the scholars. That's the challenge, to put them in some boxes, types. In the book, therefore, I use continuum in addition to typology. One thing you are definitely right, that's why I put Germany and Turkey in the same type. I say Germany is secular, Turkey secular. But in both cases, there is enormous level of deviation from the Weberian ideal type. What makes Turkey different from Greece, Denmark, and UK is that in all three cases, there is explicit establishment of Church of England and England. Then in the Greek Orthodox Church in Greece and Lutheran Church in Denmark. That's why in a very broad categorization, they are different. Turkey doesn't have one clearly officially established religion. But when we put them in a continuum, definitely, let's say, for example, Turkey is less secular than United States on this particular issue. The challenge here, for example, for the United States, we define it since 1791 as a secular state, but definitely United States was favoring Protestantism. For about a century or so, until the Monkey Trial and the Prohibition, there was a cultural semi-establishment of Protestantism. But for me, it was still a secular state. In the case of France, some people define it as a neither laic nor Catholic, but Catholic country, because all the church buildings built before 1906 are public property. And one out of two public schools have priests, chaplains, and on Fridays, for example, they serve fish in French public schools because Catholics don't want to eat meat. There are so many exceptions. Alsace-Lorraine regions, which includes Strasbourg, the French president appoints the bishops. Therefore, even France can hardly be categorized as a secular state. And the Turkish mother and French mother, but your point about Diyanet is a very important one. Why? Because when I look at passive and assertive secularism, these two categories are not monolithic either. Secularism is not monolithic, passive assertive, but passive secularism is not monolithic because in the United States we have accommodations versus separationists. Same thing for assertive secularism. It has two types. When the French Parliament discussed the separation law in 1904 and 1905, there were two alternatives. One alternative was defended by Prime Minister until 1904, Emile Combes, and Combes was saying that the Catholic Church would be too dangerous if it is separated. Therefore, it should be kept under state control. The French state should keep paying the salaries of the priests to keep them under secular state control. But some others, like Jaurès and some Socialist Party members, provide the alternative of separation, saying that, no, we should overnight cut the salaries, separate the church, but made some church properties public property. And the second project won. In the Turkish case, it was the Emil Combes, the first project, to keep Islam under state control. Even today in France, there is certain tendency among politicians like Sarkozy to keep Islam under somehow state control, having some umbrella organization, providing some education and salary. And in the Algerian colony, for example, the assertive secular state kept Islam completely under control. That's how I understand that Turkish assertive secularism, yes, definitely there is Diyanet and state control, but it is one type of assertive secularism. It is different from France, but still the two have many similarities. But for the future, definitely, I am proposing and or even the Diyanet's former leader and current leader propose, and I support their proposal, that the Diyanet should have two reforms. One, administratively, there should be a board of trustees that appoint the chairman rather than the prime minister and government. The second budget, the Diyanet budget, should be cut out of the state. And as you rightly mentioned, the state confiscated pious foundations if it let them to use independently some sources for salaries of the imams, then Turkey will become more genuinely secular state. You are right.
Jeff Rubin from Cura. Could you say a little bit about what the significance is of being a passive secular state versus an assertive secular state? In other words, why is that distinction matter? Why is it? I understand that it affects what can be taught in the schools and what people wear, but does it tell us something more about the society or the politics? Or,
In all three cases, I realize the importance at the very heart of politics. Because in the Turkish case, there was a closure case against the ruling party, Justice and Development Party, in 2008, and some people define it as a judicial coup. So the judicial coup attempt failed only by just one vote, because 10 out of 11 members of the Constitutional Court defined the ruling party anti-secular, but only 6 voted for the closure of the party, because the closure also meant the end of political life for prime minister, president, and 70 major deputies. And instead of 7 required votes out of 11, they only got 6. So therefore, the definition of secularism is important. At that time, when I wrote op-eds and gave interviews, I was telling that to the Turkish public, that actually this party is secular. But they say, oh, but they oppose Kemalism, because Kemalism has its own understanding of secularism, but this party has its own understanding of secularism. Same thing is happening in France. That's not something I invented. It already exists in the French intellectual debates, laïcité de combat, laïcité pluriel. Those who support assertive secularism in France don't like this adjective, passive, pluralistic, open, new. They say there's one secularism, that's it. When I was trying to present a paper in Paris, the chairman of the panel asked me to change the title, because the title was two types of secularism. He said, no, there's only one type. What type are you talking about? And in the United States, I was criticized by some scholars who were very angry to hear that U.S. is categorized as a secular state. They said, no, you don't know United States. It's not secular. And I said, do you know Lemon case, 1791, when the Supreme Court put 3 criteria for any law to be constitutional, that the law's intention should be secular, wording should be secular, and the direct implication should be secular? That's a highly secularistic decision of the Supreme Court. And the Everson case in 40s also said that there should be a wall of separation. That's even more secular than the French case that we see. So therefore, this typology, at least I hope, help us to understand the nuance rather than seeing secularism as a monolithic case. And similarly, when the Prime Minister Erdogan brought the issue of secularism, Muslim Brothers and several other groups in Egypt and several Islamists in Turkey were outraged. And they say, how come Prime Minister recommend them to be secular? Because we so much suffer out of secularism in Turkey, and Egyptians, do you want them to suffer as well? But what I mentioned in some interviews recently, that actually Prime Minister was not referring to Kemalist secularism. He's referring to something more American type, more passive type of secularist.
Hi. My question was that you advocate path dependency, and previously with the Ottoman Empire, the mosque and the state were very closely linked, and you advocate passive secularism, and Ataturk was definitely an assertive secularist. Do you think that Ataturk went too far in his policies, or were they necessary, or a proper solution, a necessary break from the previous status quo to something that would eventually emerge as a stable secular state?
There's an anecdote, if we go back to Jefferson again, who mentioned that the Edmund Burke's book on French Revolution seems to me more impressive than the French Revolution itself. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I think Edmund Burke was right criticizing the French Revolution, that it was too radical. It will be counterproductive, and it happened in the French case. That's why we have the first republic in U.S. and fifth republic in France, right? So in the Turkish case, radicalism produce certain counterproductive results as well. So therefore, I don't agree with religious policies or ethnic policies toward the Kurds ethnically. The state was too radical, tried to homogenize, and it was completely counterproductive. And then for the religious people, again, it was too assertive. That's my perspective. But at least I can tell that we can leave the historical leaders in their own context. And if we look at today, there's no need to bring ideas from 1920s. That's what I say, that there are Ataturkists with the general idea of modernization, civilization. Many Turks would agree with these ideas. Then that's the Kemalist dogmatic ideology. Only 20%, maybe less, agree with these ideas.
Thank you for, again, an excellent presentation, and thank you to all of the participants today for a series of really outstanding questions from the floor. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Ahmed Kuru, Associate Professor of Political Science at San Diego State University. Professor Kuru's lecture was titled Secular States and Religions, Comparing the United States, France, and Turkey. And it was presented by the Boston University Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. Tonight's moderator was Institute Director Dr. Robert Hefner. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.